Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Books in Canadian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Phil Henderson, the host of the channel, and today I'll be talking with Ricardo Tranjan, author of The Tenant Class, published in 2023 by Between the Lines Press. Ricardo, welcome to the show.
Hello, and thanks for having me here.
I wonder, Ricardo, if you could start off with just telling us a bit about yourself.
I am a political economist with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, the CCPA, a think tank often described as left-leaning that has been around for some 40 years. We're independent, we're nonpartisan, and we rely mostly on the donation of individual donors that is what allowed us to be so independent and to weigh in on any issue and to have no strings attached. We have historically supported the labor movement and other social movements as much as we can by providing research and analysis that they can use to further their causes. Before working for the CCPA, I was with the City of Toronto, the municipal government. I was leading and then managing the poverty reduction strategy that was approved around 2016. And before that, I was hiding a little bit in academia, doing my doctoral work that focused most on the economics of participatory democracy in Brazil, the country where I was born and raised. And that's it.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. It might be most helpful to the listeners if you could explain what the titular tenant class is. Why do you insist on the importance of describing it as a class in particular?
The ultimate goal of the book is to repoliticize the housing question. We talk about the so-called housing crisis a lot, like a lot. Like basically every day in the news. But we very consistently avoid, and I would argue in some cases evade, the questions of power and politics, which has always been very central to land and housing. So the book takes a political economic perspective, take a slightly more historical perspective, and uses terms and frameworks that are known, largely known, like classes and class struggle, exploitation, appropriation, to politicize housing, to say, well, let's have the real conversation here. Let's talk about the class that is being exploited, and let's talk about the class that is enormously benefiting from the status quo.
That's fantastic. What are some of the common myths about the tenant class that you discuss in the book and uncovered throughout your research? What social function do myths like this serve, and could you correct them for us?
Yes, when you take that political, economic, and historical approach to any question, you inevitably stumble into some cultural aspects, right? And you can't avoid them. You ended up going there anyways, and a bunch of theorists and researchers ended up doing that, and including folks that influenced my training quite a bit, like Antonio Gramsci and Paulo Freire and others. So when I was doing this work, I stumbled into the almost obsession with home ownership in Canada. It's a big thing. Like we equate home ownership with making it, with being successful, with achieving that middle class status. And a priori, there's no problem with that, except that the next step in that process is to develop some negative views of those who do not make it, quote unquote, do not achieve or access homeownership, meaning tenants. So there's a bunch of negative stigma around tenants. So the book, it was originally actually just a section in a chapter about the tenant class. I touched on some of these myths and stigma, and my editor read it, and she was like, no, this needs to be a chat. You need to unpack this because this is really important. This goes to the core of the issue. I really enjoy reading. I think others will too. You need to unpack them more, make it into an entire chapter. So I did. So I talk about things like the notion that tenants are young. And they will grow up one day and buy a house, right? Which the data doesn't support. The majority of primary maintainers, meaning the person in the household with the highest income in tenant households, are over 40 years old. And so the notion that renting and being in a bad place with, you know, poor maintenance and all of this as kind of like almost a rite of passage that students go through and then they grow up and buy a house and they off they go. That it's a story that applies only to a segment of the population. For many people, for a larger, large share of the population, that is a long-term housing situation, much like the minimum wage. Again, we have the myths about minimum wage too, that is only young kids, you know, bagging groceries that earn the minimum wage. But then you go to the grocery store, you see that they're not actually that young. The second myth that I talk about a little bit is the notion that tenants don't pay property taxes. It's obviously and clearly built into the rent, but it's rarely articulated as such. When we talk about property taxes, we're usually talking about homeowners and what they think and what's their political stance and how election results may swing one way or another if a mayor or a mayor candidate takes one position or other on the issue. So I talk about that a little bit too. I talk about the notion that tenants are not as active in the workforce as homeowners, and that's also absolutely not true. The participation rents for individuals who live in tenant households is very similar. It's slightly below, but very similar to individuals who live in homeowner households, home-owned households. And then lastly, I talk about this idea that everyone absolutely wants to be a homeowner, and talk a little bit about the advantages of being a renter, which are kind of underrated and under discussed. But to take a step back, the purpose of all of this is twofold. First, especially at the federal level, but also the provincial level, politicians pay a lot of attention to prospective home buyers. They continually sell the white picket fence dream at the detriment of talking about policies that could improve the situations of not the lowest income segment of the population that needs subsidizing housing or some sort of non-government housing, but what I estimate to be about 70% of the tenant population, which are not in a position to aspire to home ownership at this point, neither would they qualify to any subsidies. So about 70% are between the two, and we don't talk a lot about it. And the second reason that I try to emphasize, actually that I try to address and demystify these negative aspects, these negative views about tenants, is that from a political perspective, from an organizing perspective, it's hard to mobilize and organize a group if there is negative or stigma attached to that identity, right? So you have to kind of like remove some of that negative stigma and try and make folks more easily identify with that group. And hopefully that supports a process of political consciousness and political organizing.
That's excellent. Thanks, Ricardo. And I think also on top of the ideological function that you've just nicely pointed out there, as I was reading the book, it became really clear that one of the political economic functions of the myths that we have about the tenant class, especially because it's coded as so young, as you say, is that we don't really need to build in adequate social infrastructure like, say, a good retirement program for most people, because in Canada, retirement is expected to be based off of the fact that you've become a homeowner at some point in your life and sell your home and therefore live off of that windfall, which is just increasingly not the case, especially as homeownership itself becomes further and further out of reach for most people. So it has this like class stratifying feature, even amongst working people, between whether they're tenants or landlords in old age as well. Which actually brings us nicely to the next question, and that is, against the tenant class, you juxtapose what I take to be their antithesis, the land-owning class. And in particular, I think landlords, which might be a fragment or a sort of element within the land-owning class. Could you tell the listeners a bit about what we know regarding the social composition of landlording in Canada today? That is, who or what groups are amongst the land-owning classes are actually renting residential properties, and what are some of the common myths that we might have about this group?
So in March of 2020, when the pandemic hit us for the first time, the CCPA researchers got together and said, what are we going to do? We need to jump in. We need to support government in developing the measures and the programs that we're going to need in order to just weather this crisis that we had no idea how long it would be. We just knew that the economy had been partially shut down. And we also had a lot of media requests. Our phone was ringing nonstop because we were one of the few groups in the country that had long been advocating for a strong welfare state, for government intervention. A lot of the think tanks that argue that government should withdraw, that there's no role for intervention, and that tax should be cut, and that the state should disappear. They were nowhere to be seen when the pandemic hit. So our phone was ringing quite a bit. And so I said, okay, I'm going to look at tenant housing and rental housing. I'm going to look at tenants and I'm going to see what we can produce. So in a few days, I did an analysis that showed that tenants, most tenant households could not go 2 or 3 months without employment income without falling to arrears. They would not have enough money to pay rent. And we could see, you know, a tsunami of evictions if that was the case. Mind you, this was before the announcement of the CERB that played an important role in preventing that. And so I published the piece and then I got a lot of media calls. It was timely. It had nice and crisp numbers. It was well received, and I start talking to radio stations and TV stations across the country. And so often when I said we need some sort of rent forgiveness program, we need to immediately freeze rents, and we're gonna need some rent forgiveness programs. Folks will not be able to pay rent. And then so often the response that I got was, but what about the landlords? And that's what it dawned to me, that in Canada, we equate the financial security of tenants with that of landlords, as if they were in equal footing. The hosts, great people that I had met and worked with before, they were genuinely concerned about how landlords and how they would make. So later on, you know, after months and when I started working on the book, I decided to address that question. What about the landlords? And essentially what the chapter argues is that they will be fine because, in fact, there's only about 45 to 50% of landlords that would be characterized as small business or individual investors or mom and pop landlords. the other half, it's pretty large corporations and what we call now financialized landlords, which means there are financial, usually real estate investment trusts that have apartment buildings as a financial asset and manage them as such. So that's the first aspect of addressing that myth, is saying, well, we're only talking of a portion of all landlords. And then of that portion, you have to look into it. And when you do, you say, well, these are small businesses. And small businesses that have margins of profit that are reasonable or average, as such, they have to incur risks. As such, they have to be used to the notion that there might be at some point revenue losses. We have to talk them as small businesses. And there's another smaller share of that, which are investors, people who decided to put a down payment on a second, third, sometimes a fourth property to use them as additional source of income, in decent income, and not only income, but wealth accumulation. And again, we have been convinced by public opinion, by our governments, that real estate is really high returns and almost no risk. And to the point now that I would argue some folks who do that, who invest in that way and who become landlords, almost feel entitled to that return. Whenever I go and say, well, if you lose money, you lose money. You try to win big at low risk. You lost a little bit, usually operational losses, right? And not actually losses in your capital investment, because that more than pays for itself and usually covers your operational loss too. So even if you have a bad couple of years, in the long run, it is really hard to lose money on your estate, right? Even if you try hard, it would be difficult to do so. So I address all of this, and my ultimate argument is, look, at least more than half, slightly more than half of landlords are large corporations and investment trusts. Then the other part, they're small business, they're investors, they're families that have a net wealth that is much higher, much, much higher than average. So let's not equate the financial security of low-income families who are trying to just secure a roof over their heads with the financial security of folks that are going for the second, third, or fourth investment property.
And I wonder, Ricardo, if I could get you just to expand a little bit about what your thoughts on the impact of CERB, which for American listeners or those outside of Canada was an emergency income relief program that the federal government implemented during the first wave of the COVID-19 pandemic that provided, I'm forgetting the exact numbers right now, but something like $2,500 per month per household in relief money directly. So it functioned as something like a universal basic income with some really important caveats attached to that in terms of who was excluded, mostly people who were already outside of the labor market in the year prior to the pandemic. So serious structural impediments. But I wondered if you could just comment, based on the class analysis that this book is putting forward, about the way in which CERB actually did certainly keep working people and tenant families in particular afloat during the initial crisis of COVID-19, but also had this kind of almost insidious function of stabilizing class relationships through the pandemic, whereas other solutions like those that you gestured towards, such as not just rent forgiveness, but the abolition of rent, say, could have altered the composition of class relationships in the country as a whole.
Served as a de facto bailout to the landlord class. There's no question there. And I think at that time, given where we had been politically and economically, was the right thing to do, because we needed a fast response. I was happy that the government for once act with a level of resolve that we hadn't seen for decades. But what I regret is the fact that there hasn't been any lessons learned from that, right? In fact, what I found interesting is that at the end of the first, beginning of the second year of the pandemic, the Landlord Association in Ontario put forward a proposal arguing that the government should essentially help to make them whole. So data came out showing that there was only about 9 to 10% of rent in arrears in Ontario. And compared to the financial and economic disaster that we were seeing in so many other industries, that was fairly low. And yet, landlords proposed that government should pay for a third of that loss, tenants should pay for another third of their loss, and then they were willing to absorb a third, meaning they were willing to only absorb a 3.3 loss in the revenue in the first year of the pandemic. They had the audacity to make that document public and submit it to the government of Ontario, which begs the question, like, how entitled are they that they think they should always be made whole, no matter what? The house is burning and they're like, where's my profit? I will not, you know, forego a dollar. So I'm afraid that we haven't learned anything from that, that we haven't questioned the very basic political economic question of, if there's so much money and opportunity to make easy money with what's called economic rent, how much are we foregoing in investment, in wages, in economic activity that actually has spillover effects, right? It's a very classic and very old economic argument that easy money through rent will crowd out investment for more productive sectors of the economy. We're not having that conversation yet. And I think that the pandemic showed, you know, that the situation showed what the situation is and would have allowed us to have that conversation, but we're not there yet.
So in the tenant class, you suggest, and you've already done so in this interview too, that contrary to much popular discourse, quote, there is no housing crisis in Canada today. Instead, there's just good old landlords squeezing high rents from tenants. Could you first explain why we shouldn't think of the current housing situation with its poor infrastructure, its high rents, low vacancies, and increasing houselessness through the lens of crisis, and why you prefer the language of class conflict instead? How do you measure the relative balance of power in this conflict?
Yes, I have a huge beef with the housing crisis because I think it depoliticizes, essentially depoliticizes the housing question. If you think about a crisis, we think about something that is unexpected or surprising, as a kind of a shock, like the pandemic. Whereas the structure of the rental market and the housing market more broadly hasn't changed for decades and decades in Canada. The situation has been gradually getting worse for tenants, but it's not surprise and is definitely not unexpected. We saw it coming. We let it go that direction. And I think we're just seeing how long we can get away with it. And we, by we, I mean the real estate industry and the political class that supports it. Just, you know, how long can we, you know, keep the music playing and how long can we keep the bonuses coming? And when we can't anymore, then maybe we're going to have to do something about it. Not much different than 2008. So that's not a crisis in that aspect. A crisis also is something that impacts most people negatively, maybe everyone negatively. Again, definitely not the case. You know, there's a lot of folks who are enormously benefiting from the status quo. And then the third piece of it is that the language of crisis suggests that everyone is interested in solving this problem, that you can bring the different stakeholders around the table. Everyone are going to make very serious, pensive faces, and we're going to, you know, find out a solution that solves the problem, because everyone wants this crisis to go away. And that couldn't be farthest from the truth. There are folks right now actively lobbying for the situation to restate the way it is, and actually proposing and trying to push legislation that would make things worse. So not at all, people are not invested in solving this as they would in a crisis situation. So I think that language of housing crisis just depoliticized the issue, and it's not very helpful.
Definitely. And in terms of how we actually conceptualize a balance of power here, you detail in the book that one of the sort of standard ways in which the exploitation of the tenant class is measured is rent as a percentage of income. And it's standard that, and as you point out, quite arbitrary, that 30% or more of your income per month going to rent is considered an above acceptable level of rent. What are some alternatives to this model that you point to in the book, and why are they maybe better ways of thinking about the rate of exploitation that's embedded in the rentier relationship?
It's one of the things that I also am constantly mesmerized by, the fact that we do not ask the landlord class how much profit's enough. What's your end game? When do you stop asking for farther and farther increases, right? We have normalized the notion that rents will go up by however much the market will bear, and that's okay. And of course, we have neoclassic economics to blame here, right? Supply and demand charts allow you to describe the world without requiring you to provide a moral or any normative justification for why things are the way they are, right? So it's just a description void of any normative arguments. And that actually implicitly has a normative outcome of normalizing what we see as being natural, right? So in other words, we hear constantly that the prices of housing or price of rent are going up because there's not enough supply. And then if you increase supply, prices will stabilize. And we rarely talk about the fact that constrained supply allows landlords to hike up rents by a lot, but that the ultimate decision to do so and the ultimate action in the agency rests with landlords. But we don't question that. We don't question that landlords will push rents as far as they can. And I think that's the kind of power in politics dynamics that we have to talk about. I published an op-ed not long ago in the Toronto Star where I said rents don't go up. Rents don't go up, landlords raise rents, and they are to blame in large part to the skyrocketing rents that we are seeing in Toronto right now. And I got so much pushback. People were furious by the notion that they were part of the people, and by people I mean landlords, they were furious that someone would dare to point at them as part of the problem and not part of the solution. I think to answer your question more directly, I think from a political and from a communications perspective, the real estate industry has an enormous amount of power. They have managed very successfully to frame this issue. Landlords and developers are constantly presented as the solution to the problem. They're constantly presented as the ones that need less regulations, more government incentives, more subsidies. And then if you give them to them, they will be able to get us out of this crisis. They're never presented as the problem, as the ones that are pocketing too much money, as the ones who greedy is making house insecurity a different type of pandemic in this country. So they did well in terms of framing this conversation.
And I think also, as you point out in the book, and as others like Francesca Manning have pointed out in some recent research as well, is that one of the things that neoclassical economics, as you said, invites us to is this amoral assessment of things. But it also invites us into a really bad set of descriptive elements, in that land or rental space is not like other commodities, in the sense that, A, it's finite. There's only so much land upon which you can build, no matter how high you want to go in the country or in the world. And B, it's non-disposable, really, in the same way that, like, to use, I think, I forget if it's in Tenant Class or if it's in Manning's work, but a landlord is not the same thing as, like, a banana salesperson, in that it is in Tenant Class. Yeah, a banana salesperson has a stake in moving product off the shelves. Whereas, as you point out in your book, and it, as you alluded to before, a landlord can sit on the property, and because of our expectation that property valuation continues to go up and up and up, still make money. And so it has no actual incentive to push the renting side of things in the same way in which other commodities have to get off the shelves.
Yes. Another person who has been doing really good work on this is Josh Ryan Collins in the UK. And his work reminds us that all the classic economists, the political economists of back then, they understood this very clearly. They understood that land, as you described, it's finite, it's perpetual, it's non-transportable, it's fixed in place, and it has all these kinds of attributes that make it very weird and different and extremely valuable, and it's at the center of political contention. And all of them had a sort of special treatment to how we're going to deal with that question. And even the liberals among them worried about people hoarding land and being able to generate too much economic rent and the negative impact that would have in economic growth and economic activity. And they wanted to tax it heavily. And of course, the socialists and the anarchists have also problems with it, but they had a different sets of solutions for it. And we sort of forgot all of this when, you know, new class economics became so dominant, and we removed all the power in politics, and we start treating land as if it was just another capital asset, and as if the supply and demand models would apply to it equally well as it does to other products and other goods and services. So yeah, it's there where you see the very clear role that how new classic economics can be used in a political way in order to very deliberately depoliticize a particular issue.
Mm-hmm. And I think you've already started to allude to the answer here, so I might reframe my question from our notes a little bit, which is that you suggest that it's important to shift our framing from what you call technical solutions, which you were sort of outlining before, to a political approach to the housing question. And I want you to discuss what the substantive distinction between these technical solutions is and the political approach that you advocate for. What's the consequence? And also, does this tie into your critique of expertise that you lay out throughout the book? In particular, the types of people who typically get allowed to call themselves housing experts. Why is that a problem?
I see in Canada an enormous emphasis on a particular type of civil society. We have what sometimes in some democratic theory was described as like the third sector, meaning it's a civil society that is comprised mostly of professionals who engage in these questions of policy and social services and social programs in their professional capacity from 9 to 5. And why that is an important aspect of a sort of overall healthy democratic system, I see in Canada, in comparison to other places I studied, lived in other places that both contemporary but also in the past, that civil society, that third sector, takes a lot of space and engages very directly with government all the time, and often is the sole interlocutor of non-governmental points of views and perspectives. And we're speaking mostly of folks exactly like myself, you know, research and policy analysts who are paid to do this. And there's a lot of less emphasis or a lot of less space for social movements, which in some, again, sometimes we distinguish between that civil society called third sector and social movements, which are more grassroots, which are folks that do not have any allegiance to a particular organization, that do not operate with any institutional constraints. They're really driven by a cause and a political agenda. And they engage with government and with political parties or with directly with capital in a more confrontational perspective, because it is their interest and their needs against the interest of others. So it's kind of intrinsically more politically, because it is about defending our livelihood versus ensuring profit to the landlord in this particular case. Whereas with the civil society approach, what I see too often is this notion that we can arrive at a win-win solution. We can find a policy solution that will work for everybody. And then I find myself in places where around the table we have corporate landlords, we have investors, the banking industry, and a neighborhood organization, and some tenant movement, and then a bunch of policy folks, researchers like myself with various allegiances and institutional constraints. And we're all talking as if there was no conflict, as if, again, we're all interested in coming around the table and find a solution for us. And I think that is just, in practical terms, that serves just as a delaying tactic for the government to look busy without changing anything, to look busy without addressing the huge elephant in the room, which is the power dynamics, which is the fact that the landlords and the developers and the banking industry representatives around the table, they are there essentially to stall progress, to keep things the way they are. And it's just everyone else wants to change the status quo. But that is never said explicitly in those meetings. This is kind of like a pretend game. So I find that experts and researchers and other folks who participate in policy development and program development have an extremely important role to play in certain parts of the process. I would argue later in the policy development process, once governments have actually decided to act, have actually decided to invest, and they are now trying to figure out the how to make sure that the policy, the program, the measure will be adequately designed, will be targeted so as to actually reach the person and the population groups that are aimed at. That at that point, I think that experts can play a very important role, but we're not there. With housing, we're so not there. Like, we are at a much earlier stage where governments need to be pushed into action, needs to be pressured to step away from representing so deliberately and so consistently the interests of the rent real estate industry and the landlord class. And that, you know, that political pressure won't come from the experts. That will come from social movements. That will come from political organizing.
With that, like, sense of sort of where the landscape is at right now in terms of how heavily tilted it is towards the interest of a landowning class, what are some of the models of tenant organizing that you explain and then differentiate within the book between, say, neighborhood and regional approaches to tenant organizing, as well as what you describe as territorial organizing? And then following on from that, after you've laid out the different types of organizing, what are the various tactics that are deployed by tenant organizing?
Yes, the book starts that part of the work with a historical chapter. And then the first goal there is to call attention to the fact that tenant organizing is not new. It dates back from before Confederation. And it has been seen everywhere in the country, from east to west, to large cities, to small towns. It's been a constant, actually, in Canadian history, but one that we pay a lot less attention that makes to our history books a lot less often. And the role of that chapter is bringing a little bit of that out in hopes that supports current organizers in understanding and knowing that there is a history, that what they're doing today is part of a historical fight. In terms of the different models that exist today and that have also existed in the past, some tenant groups choose to work within a very clearly delineated territory and just build working class power in that space. And their focus is to have enough strength to essentially fight anything that comes their way. So they're less interested in forming political coalitions or participating in policy debates or any of that. Capitalists and governments will do what they will do, and they will often just try to maneuver the so-called left, or they will try to maneuver political movements to suit their own goals. So they prefer to stay out of all of that and very focused on local power.
An example of that you lay out in the book is Parkdale Organize, yes. Right? Where they're organizing both tenants who live in Parkdale and workers who come to Parkdale to work, right? So it's a like double move of worker and tenant organizing, right?
Yeah, and workers in Parkdale too. And again, their idea is to be ready for whatever comes. It needs to be, they have this clear sense that no one else is coming to help us. We have to help ourselves, period. There are other organizations that are more willing to form coalitions. I think the right term would be they're more interested and more hopeful with forming organizations, broader coalitions. And they see that the local level work against, mostly against landlords on the day-to-day fights should be supplemented by some political work that aims at policies that could change, alter the dynamics of power locally. So to give a practical example, whereas tenants are often fighting what we call in Canada the above guideline rent increases, which is sort of like a loophole that allows landlords to increase rents by more than the rent guideline for that year. They're fighting that all the time with like rent strikes and other collective actions, but they would like to see legislation that it eventually abolish above guideline increases as an option altogether. And so they will organize with political parties, with councillors, and they will try to push legislation too. One good example also, it's in Quebec. Quebec has a strong history of tenant militantism. And in the 1970s, late 1970s, there was already a lot of tenants organized locally. A comité logement, like this is the term for in Quebec. And at some point, they got tired of playing defense all the time. And they said, no, we need to form coalitions and we need to start interacting at other levels. And they formed two organizations that do play that role, and they have slightly different models. One organization, you know, has a kind of paid staff, and it's organized in a way that is democratically organized internally, but it has a structure and engages with policy, provincial and federal levels. The other organization, it's more a regroupement. Like, so it's just a coalition that brings together all the local tenant unions to sometimes pick a fight or to you know, do like collective action against one particular measure, which is the case right now, actually, in Quebec. So there are various models, and I'm very explicit in my writing and in my engagement with this topic that I'm a researcher and I'm not an organizer, so I'll never be prescriptive about what's the right or the wrong model. It's for tenant organizers themselves to decide based on their own realities and their discussions and their strategic strategizing what is the best model for them. But there are plenty. There are plenty of models, and there's plenty of activism going on right now.
That's great. This is sort of me reflecting as you're speaking. And if we accept that there's a type of analogy between tenant organizing and worker organizing, which, as you pointed to, several tenant organizations work under that assumption, one of the, I think, correct accusations that's been leveled against labor organizations in the history of Canada as a white settler colony is that they have often made advances for workers, in particular white male workers, on the back of excluding either Indigenous people or racialized people who are coming to Canada, and largely excluding women as a whole as well. Are there similar issues in the history of tenant organizing, but also conversely, just to speculate, what do you think an anti-colonial tenant movement in Canada could look like in an age in which land back is such a prominent demand amongst Indigenous communities?
That is a huge and hugely important question, because when we talk about housing and rental housing, we're obviously talking about housing that is built on land. So the next question is, whose land are we demanding access to? This house, what does it mean in terms of what claims we're making about our right to be in particular land? And I haven't looked in depth on my historic examples to see what they were like in terms of inclusion and in terms of awareness of other aspects of diversity within their own movements. My sense with the current organizations that I studied and folks that I talked to and interviewed for the book is that they are really conscious of the need to have a very diverse membership and to be very inclusive of the different population groups that represent Canadian right now. That comes almost naturally, to be true, to be honest, because the tenant population in itself, it's very diverse and includes large shares of marginalized groups. So it would be kind of tone deaf completely or almost impossible not to make sure that everyone is involved. And I think there's a couple organizations that have been also struggling with the question of land back and what that means for their organizing. In the book, I mention the Vancouver Tenants Union. They, I think in part because the nature of where they are and the history of that particular territory, they're very conscious of it. Not that they have a definitive answer to the question, neither do I, but it's something that the movement is thinking, parts or segments of the movement is thinking, right? What does it mean to be inclusive? What does it mean to be claiming access or right to housing in this particular time and place and in a land that has the sort of the history of murder and genocide that we still live with and we live with the consequences and the continued perpetration of those crimes. So I think my final word is that I'm hopeful that we can learn from the labor movement and skip that stage and in the tenant movement.
Right. I think that's definitely what we need to be aiming at. My last primary question for you is admittedly quite an academic one, but I'm going to proceed anyway. So the tenant class takes, as you've accounted for, a modified Marxian account of class conflict as its primary theoretical lens. And while your focus is on the tenant class itself, its antagonists in landlords lurk around every corner, basically. I take it from your discussion that you understand landlords to be part of the broader capitalist class. But this is a position which isn't without controversy within Marxian thought itself. So what, to your mind, is the analytical or political upshot of seeing landlords and the capitalist class as an integrated whole? Does this integrative analysis extend to the whole of the land-owning class, i.e. those who own land but are not landlords? And if so, may analytical integration of this sort obscure other important dynamics, such as we've been talking about, settler colonialism, that could be helpful in spotlighting how we see the landowning class as a third class that articulates portions of both the capitalist and working classes towards one another?
So the original draft of the book had a much longer discussion of the concept of class and how I was using it. And eventually we decided to drop it because we want to ensure an accessible, fast-paced kind of reading, but also because there are questions there that I think I need more time to think about and to talk and to discuss. So I appreciate that opportunity to do so. I think there are two ways in which I would explain or perhaps even justify the use of class. First, I think there's a tradition within Marxism, broadly defined, not specifically scholarly endeavors, but Marxism more broadly defined, where folks use the term class loosely when that can be helpful, where that can support emancipatory projects. Here we think about the ultimate goal of Marxism is practice, and you're going to use those concepts and that frame of analysis however you can to put more wind behind your movement. The ultimate goal is to push for the emancipation of subaltern classes. And I think that here has also become obvious that my Latin American background, because I think in the South, there's a more of a tradition of doing that because Marxist concepts and analysis didn't always quite fit the realities on the ground. So you had to kind of like push and stretch and adapt it and the concepts as you went a little bit to sort of fit what you're seeing in the world, fit the people you're trying to put a fight against and all sorts of things. So in that sense, I hope the Marxist gods will forgive me for using class that loosely, because the ultimate goal here is to support the fight against the landlord class. And in as far as the term class helps that fight, it justifies itself in that perspective. The other perspective, which would be more academic, I think that, you know, when Engels wrote the very extensive essay where he essentially argues that no, the landlords are not the capitalist class. They're two different things. The fundamental distinction is at the point of production. It cannot be at the point of consumption. So landlords and the capitalist tenants and labor, they're not equivalents and they should be treated differently. Well, quite a bit has changed since then. And to go back to even our just kind of previous conversation, one of the things that we're more willing to accept is the whole role of the care economy, the role of the reproductive work, and not only productive work, right? So then you start, you know, thinking about, okay, so, you know, if reproductive work is as important as production, what does it mean for how you treat housing, which is that ultimately the basis for reproduction and care and that whole aspect of human activity that does not take place in a factory, but that we now recognize as important. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is the financialization of housing and the greed to itch. Right now, housing and it's so embedded in the flows of capital, right? As like in supports it in so many different ways, as a place to park capital, most importantly, which again goes back to some of our earlier comments about the supply and demand and how it's a quite simplistic understanding of housing, because it plays that very important role in capital, in the flow of capital, of just storing wealth for a little bit, just park money here and there and all over the world, and how now the role that the real estate industry is playing in just leveraging debt and leveraging money that goes into all sorts of other economic sectors. And so that whole integration of capital and real estate, and of course I'm bastardizing some of the explanations that David Harvey kind of provides us in understanding that. Also, I think could be an argument for rethinking whether the tenant class and those who are excluded from owning property are in a similar or more analogous position than those who are, you know, have no choice but to sell their labor. So I think it's worth revisiting whether or not their relationship has become a little bit more similar than we thought it was in the past. And the final thing I would say is the question that you posed is really interesting, the land owning class, right? And where do they fall in all of this? And in the book, I stay away a little bit from that because I thought I had packed enough in that very short book already to address that question of essentially home ownership and where does that crowd falls as folks who are not perpetrators of the kind of predatory practices that we see from many landlords, and they are like trying to, you know, maximize profit margins and investments and so on. They're also not at the other end of it, just having their a share of their income appropriated monthly from the landlord class. They are in a position where they're benefiting from this situation. They are like a petit bourgeois of sort. But yeah, it's worth revisiting what their role is in all of this and what we could or should expect of them.
Yeah, I think as I look at the most recent municipal election here in Toronto, or, you know, every election cycle that comes through, the mapping of even on the partisan landscape in Canada, as narrow as it is, the mapping of left versus right partisan returns onto a map of the suburbs where there's a higher incident rate of ownership versus a map of a downtown core, you can quite easily see how home ownership actually shapes partisan directions. And there's a whole implied political ethos that goes behind that as well.
It does, especially when folks start expecting their houses to provide more than a home, their houses to provide large financial gains. It changes their political perspectives, I think.
So finally, it's traditional at the New Books Network to close by asking guests what they're working on now. Ricardo, if you have ongoing research or community projects that you'd like to highlight, please feel free to do so now.
I would like to call attention to two rent strikes that are presently happening in Toronto. One is in the neighborhood of Weston. It has been organized by York Southwestern Tenant Union. It's an apartment building on 33 King Street, not the famous King Street downtown, another King Street in the inner suburbs. It is a building that has received a series of above guideline rent increases in the past years, and tenants just kind of had enough, and they went on a strike on June 1st, and they are receiving all sorts of threats and menacing correspondence from the landlord, but they're refusing to back down, and they're actually just growing in strength. So if anyone wants to learn more about them, it's easy to Google York Southwestern Tenant Union, and they will have the opportunity to learn more, including ways of supporting if folks are so inclined. There's a second rent strike going on in Thorncliffe Park Drive. There are three large apartment buildings that together have about 600-ish units, mostly low and moderate income tenant families. And the landlord in that case is Starlight, a large corporate landlord that actually is managing those buildings as financial assets for PSP Investments. PSP Investments is the pension fund of federal public employees. So we are in this wicked serious situation right now where the pension fund of federal public employees is about to start evicting tenants who are low and moderate income and went on a strike because they did not agree with a 10% rent increase over 2 years. They said that's too much. We have just gone through 3 years of a pandemic. Food prices are going up fast. We're having a hard time making ends meet. Can we talk? Can we negotiate? Can we, you know, try and find a solution? In Canada, landlords do not have the obligation to negotiate. Tenants do not have collective bargaining rights. So in this case, the landlord simply said no, no, and no. They said no many times to negotiating with tenants, and they're now starting to send eviction notices to those tenants. So it's a really, again, it's a really wicked and regretful situation that the pension fund of federal public employees is going ahead to evict low-income tenant families. So folks who want to learn more, they can go to also trying to browse the internet and look for Thorncliffe Park tenants. There's including one thing that you will likely bump into is a GoFund page. And the rationale there is that once the eviction notes hit tenant families, they will have to pay a fee to be able to contest the eviction. And that fee, in their case, can amount to 1 or 2 weeks of equivalent of groceries. So the GoFund, it's going largely to support them in paying those fees so that they do not have to sacrifice their family well-being because of this. So I'll just invite folks to learn more about the student strikes in New York Southwestern and in Thorncliffe Park Drive by looking up these two tenant unions and see if there's any ways they can support them.
Thanks, Ricardo. And we'll actually happily provide links to both of those organizations in the show notes for this episode so listeners can find it on their podcast app of choice. Ricardo Tranjan, author of The Tenant Class, out now from Between the Line Books, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It has been really great.